We were having a little discussion about titles. Okay, who needs copies of Mont Blanc? All right, I just Xeroxed them again. So if you need a copy, grab it. And a couple of people have to come in via Zoom. So that's going to take a sec. Oh, crap. Anyone have a charger for, I think it's USB-C. Be enough battery power, but I don't think there is. Oh, maybe it's not USB-C. Oh, no, it is. Good. How are the papers going? How's the reading of all the poems for the papers going?
Pretty good.
Pretty good? Good poems, right? You have to know what to say to professors.
Well, I mean,
it's one of the skills you learn.
I did enjoy reading them, and the one I picked, I feel like I found a lot of say on it, so.
Okay, there you go. All right, let's just see who's coming in. Oh, okay, here, two people, good. You. And, okay, we'll try to do the, we have to do some more score keys. PKlaw.law. Huh. Okay. So we're going to do more score keeping in Mont Blanc. Just to remind you, what we're looking at is this poem in which there is a world and an observer of the world, of that world. And the question is, what is, well, again, to quote Humpty Dumpty, which has priority? Is it perception or is it the thing perceived that has priority? And that is not that easy a question, especially if you're a poet. So one thing that you can say about poetry is that sometimes poets or writers in general are admired for the precision or subtlety or let's call it perceptiveness that they describe something that we have all seen. So a famous line from, you won't be surprised to hear, Pope, is that poetry is what oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed. So the couplet, since I know you want to know what the rhymes are, true art is nature to advantage dressed. So nature dressed up to look her best. What oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed. So it's like when you see something, you say, it me. That is, it's like when you see something. Can I give, here you go. When you say, wow, yeah, that's such a great description of something that you are recognizing. So one idea is that there's what's sometimes called the shock of recognition. which is an interesting phrase. That is, recognition shouldn't be shocking, but it is shocking when you recognize something which you weren't quite expecting to recognize there. So in that case, what a good poem would be a perceptive description of something that other people have also perceived. And what would make it perceptive is that it's something that people then say, wow, yeah, I couldn't have put it that way, but that's exactly what my experience of it is. In that case, what you would have is the true world, the real world, the outside world, the external world, and you would have the reflection of the picture of the reception of that world. The other question, which is not so much a poetic question, or not obviously a poetic question from the start, but certainly becomes a question once poetry starts trading in metaphors, which poetry does from the beginning. It's, again, almost definitional of poetry that it is going to use metaphors. It's really hard to find poetry that doesn't use metaphors. When you find it, we call it prose. That's what the word prosaic will tend to mean. So it's really hard to find poetry that doesn't use metaphors. Then the perception is more active. It's not just that you give a really detailed iPhone 14 picture of something that's out in the world already. It's that the way the mind interprets and retouches and creates within on the basis of what it perceives outside, that then becomes an assertion of the priority of mind to world. So that question, which has priority, mind or world, or which has priority, the poetic faculty, just to use an old-fashioned phrase, that is the powers of mind that are transformational and will transform something that is out there into something that is unique in the poem that does the transforming, versus simply that that what the poem does is to give a good and recognizable and impressive description of what's out there. You can think of this, is easy enough to see in the history of art. So there's representational art, which is, that's a good picture, it looks just like her. That's what makes it a good portrait. Versus, let's say, abstract art, experimental art, all the kinds of art that people who think art should look like what it is of think isn't art. So that's the, my kid could do that kind of art. Mm-hmm. Like, why did people like Picasso so much? My kid could do that. But all art has some aspect of both. Even abstract art is somewhat representational. Even the most abstract of abstract art is somewhat representational. And the reason that a really good portrait of someone is valued is because just looking at them somehow doesn't give you quite the same experience as looking at a picture of them. So that there's something that picturing does to what it pictures that is something other than the mere repetition of what it pictures. So there's elements of both in each extreme, elements of what perception does to what is perceived, and elements of recognition of the thing that is being perceptively described, recognition of that thing. Eli, do you remember the line in Tintern Abbey? What they half create? So there's a line in Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey where he describes what the mind does and what poets do. And it's the line is, famous line, what they half create and what perceive. So what you could say is art in general is creative perception. And poetry as one of the arts is creative perception. And so that is a philosophical, as we were saying on Tuesday, that's a philosophical issue as well, which has priority, the mind that perceives the world or the world in which the human who perceives it lives. So is it that we're just little things moving around the world that we have to perceive in order to survive, because of what got called in the 19th century, but not by Darwin, survival of the fittest. So we better perceive accurately, but the world is what endangers us and what we have to negotiate and navigate. Or is it that the mind is something that transforms the world into something interesting, that there's just a bunch of uninteresting matter out there and the mind transforms it into something interesting? So that's a question that philosophers have argued since starting in ancient India, since 2000 BCE, let's say. And it's a question about whether the world is illusion, in which case it's all in the mind, for example, or whether we are just little beings created with the creation of the world, created through evolutionary processes, let's say, and we are fundamentally biological entities, and our perceptions are only designed to further the biological needs that we have to fulfill. So there are various ways of putting this, but for poets, a lot of this will be concentrated and focused on the idea of metaphor. So the way we were looking at Mont Blanc was to look at it as, first, stanza one, a philosophical description of how the mind perceives and what it perceives. And what it perceives is the everlasting universe of things, and it's the things which flow through the mind and therefore cause the mind to perceive the things that it does. And what does the mind do there? Well, it adds a little bit of its own personality. It adds a little bit of its own being, but it's all just a dollop of that within the perception of the universe itself. So there we're getting the extreme priority of the universe. Then we get to stanza two. So this is just summarizing what we talked about Tuesday a little bit. We get to stanza two, and what we get is the first description of Mont Blanc. And we might have thought that stanza one was a description of Mont Blanc because of the title. Title, Mont Blanc Lines Written in the Vale of Chamonix, means that he's writing it, that's the valley from which you can see the mountain soaring. He's writing it while looking at the mountain. So the title is telling you, here's the mountain, and I'm looking at it as I write these lines. But then the first stanza does not describe the mountain. It describes a philosophical question or a philosophical thesis, which is that the universe flows through the mind. And again, we were looking at which had priority, the everlasting universe of things, but it flows through the mind. Nevertheless, the mind that it flows through, it somehow also controls, so that the mind is secondary to what flows through it. Then we get to stanza two, and whenever there's a stanza break in Mont Blanc, it is Shelley trying to regroup. So, end of stanza one, the mind is a feeble brook, and it's the everlasting universe of things that are producing the waterfalls that leap forever, and woods and winds and the vast river ceaselessly bursting and raving. Then stanza two, again, just to summarize very quickly, thus thou ravine of Arv. He's now looking at the mountain and the ravine and the river Arv. And he's saying, you're a good metaphor for what happens in the mind. So the thus there, I was thinking about the best way to translate thus. I actually should have looked it up, but I didn't. Probably the literal meaning of thus is something like, this is how. In the same way, this is how the ravine of Arv lies in the landscape. So thus thou ravine of Arv, thou dost lie, which is where the first main verb shows up. After you get these seven lines of description that somehow he can't stop himself from doing. So again, to summarize what we said Tuesday, the very fact that he can't stop himself, that what he wants to say, the impulse, it's like when you want to say something, and just try to pay attention sometime to the way that you're forming your own sentences as you form them. So you want to say something, but then you pause because there's something that you have to clarify before you want to say it, and you think about various things, and you're still headed towards, but maybe still not quite getting there, but you're on your way there saying something. See? You're still headed towards all those other words, saying something. And these things are occurring to you as you are speaking. We compose as we speak. This is just a fact of human language. Very few, you kind of know where your sentence is going to end, maybe when you start speaking, maybe not. But you certainly don't know all the words of your sentence unless your sentence is something really simple like, I love you, but or I hate you. But generally, you don't know the words in the sentence. They occur to you as you compose them. And what's happening here is he's got an idea. You're a really good image of what goes on in the human mind, which would mean that the world is an image of the mind. And that would mean the mind has priority. So that's what he wants to say. Thus thou dost lie. But he can't, because somehow this flood of landscape that he's looking at is taking over his own composition. So he starts describing. Thus thou, ravine of Arv, dark, deep ravine, thou many-colored, many-voiced veil over whose pines and crags and caverns sail past cloud shadows and sunbeams. Awful scene where power in likeness of the Arv comes down from the ice gulfs that gird his secret throne, bursting through these mountains like the flame of lightning through the tempest. Thus thou dost lie. So again, notice the metaphors within those lines that take over his mind as he's trying to simply say, you look like this image that I've just described in stanza one. And he says that power in likeness of the Arv comes down. So power looks like the Arv River. That's a simile. Power in likeness of the Arv comes down, except it's not quite, because power is actually coming down that way. So it's also a metaphor. It's the river. From the ice gulfs that gird his secret throne. So power has a secret throne in the mountain, which has to be a metaphor because there's no throne up there. So even within metaphors, there are metaphors and similes. So thou dost lie, that's what he wants to say. But then the scene that he's looking at grabs his attention again, and he can't stop. Thy giant brood of pines around thee clinging. So all these pine trees clinging to the edges of the ravine. Children of elder time. What does that mean?
Like they're old.
Yeah, they're children of a time before us. So elder time. So there's the now, and then there's this elder time, older than us. An interesting metaphor. Who's winning there, him or the mountain? The mountain, yeah. You were prior to us. These pines clinging to the ravine are children of elder time, in whose devotion the chainless winds still come and ever came to drink their odors. So why are the winds coming? Here, we're doing it slowly so you don't have to panic about this amazing piling on of images. So why do the winds come, according to this metaphor? It's not just, oh, it's a windy night or a windy day. There's a reason the winds are coming.
To drink their odors?
Yeah. So the winds are blowing the pines really hard, because it's as though they want to smell the pine smell of the pines that are clinging to the sides of the ravine. So the winds are devoted to the pines. They are chainless, and they come, and they've been coming forever. Ever came, that is again before humans, and ever came to drink their odors. And why else did they come? Next words?
To hear an old and solemn harmony.
Yeah, to hear the swinging of the pines and their mighty swinging to hear. And that swinging of the pines produces an old and solemn harmony. So again, this is like upon those boughs that shake against the cold. Where's that from?
That Shakespeare sonnet.
Sonnet 73, that's right. Where yellow leaves are none or few do hang upon those boughs that shake against the cold. So remember that this is metaphor. The boughs are not shaking against the cold. It's the wind that is blowing them and making them shake. So it's not, oh no, this wind is cold and I have to shiver to produce enough calories to stay warm. All you're seeing is wind blowing boughs, and there's no against there. The boughs are resisting because they're trees, but they're not resisting because it's too cold. So there the metaphor is they're shaking the way a human being shivers when they're cold. But that's not what's happening in the actual vision of boughs that winds are shaking. Same deal here. The winds are coming to drink their odors. How do we know that the pines have odors?
I wouldn't say it's odor.
What would you say?
Yeah,
so odor, yeah, odor doesn't have the meaning of BO that it does now. It didn't have back then. You could talk about bad odor, but odor was it was really synonymous with scent. So, but how do we know that pines have scents, especially if they're far away?
Wind.
Yeah, the wind blows the scent to you. So, again, there's this kind of sense that the winds are there in order to drink in the scents, the odors, that in fact we only know of because the winds are blowing them to us, and we're the ones drinking in those odors. And their mighty swinging to hear. So the winds come to hear the pines. What are they hearing?
Like
What does it mean to hear? What is that old and solemn harmony? What are you hearing?
The rustling of the trees.
Yeah. The wind in the willows, or in this case, the wind in the pines. So the winds are coming to hear that sound, but they don't hear that sound. They create that sound by blowing through the pines. So you can see it's the same thing over and over in the poem, which is that, so there's a technical term when people talk about metaphors, which is they talk about, here, I'll write this down because it's something you should know. Emily, can you pass that behind you? Thank you. Tenor and vehicle. So that's a metaphor describing how metaphors work. And the tenor is what you're supposed to get out of a metaphor. So if you say I don't want to keep saying steaming pile of shit, so I have to come up with something else. But all right, let's say you say steaming pile of shit. Something's a steaming pile of shit. That what you mean by it is it's a really bad offering or production or example of whatever it is it's supposed to be, right? Just think of any context where you say that. So that's the tenor. It's a way of saying this is no good. So one way that we say this is no good is we say this is crap. But it's not literally crap. The vehicle is what the literal meaning would be, but the tenor is what we get out of it. So it's as though the vehicle is metaphorically a vehicle that is delivering the meaning to us. So metaphor in Greek literally means to carry across. That's one reason that you would say the vehicle is carrying the tenor that is the ultimate meaning to us. If you go to Athens now, has anyone been to Athens? Anyone been to Greece? In ancient Greek, metaphor means to carry across. In modern Athens, you can see minivans that on the side, they say metaphor. Why? Because they are literally carrying people around Athens. So they're called metaphors, metaphorin, or metaphoroi. But that's what they're called now. So the metaphorical vehicle has now become a literal vehicle in Athens. But a metaphor means it's something that carries a meaning elsewhere, carries it across, brings it across, and the vehicle is what a completely literal-minded reader would think, but the tenor is what that vehicle is supposed to, wait for the word, convey. So again, think of the word convey. Literally, to convey something means to bring it from one place to another. Metaphorically, it means to get someone to understand a meaning. So I want to convey to you how seriously I take plagiarism. So I'm not going to put the seriousness with which I take plagiarism on a little toy truck and send it to you. I say metaphorically, I want to convey it to you. I don't put it on a little conveyor belt to convey it. I use the word convey metaphorically. So the vehicle, the metaphorical vehicle in a metaphor, are you okay with that triple and quadruple noticing of metaphors for metaphors? So the metaphorical vehicle of a metaphor metaphorically conveys the meaning that the person, the tenor, which is also a kind of a metaphor, the tenor of what the person who is producing the metaphor wants to bring to you. So what we're looking at here, what we were looking at in a station at the metro where you could say maybe that the subway train is a vehicle, but what we're seeing are pedals on a wet black bough, metaphorically. Interestingly enough, well, it gets really complicated, but interestingly enough, if you ask what is the tenor of that metaphor, okay, let's just ask it. So remember, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, pedals on a wet black bough. Okay, apparition of these faces in the crowd, pedals on a wet black bough. Literally, we're looking at
the faces
through the window of the subway train in the metro, in a station at the metro. Metaphorically, they're pedals on a wet black bough. But that itself is a metaphor. It's not, oh yeah, this is how shall I describe pedals on a wet black bough? How can I make you see them? Think of a subway train with a lot of faces. That's not what's going on. Somehow it's the relationship between these two things that seem so different from each other that Pound is pushing. Who else would look at a subway train? Urban, underground, noisy, crowded, and think of something that you would get in, let's say, a Chinese scroll, an ink drawing of petals on a wet black bough, which would be isolated, rarefied, as far from a city as you could be. It's a metaphor, but it's just not clear how tenor and vehicle are working there. And it's that fact that it's not a metaphor. It's not a disposable metaphor. If I say I want to convey this to you, the word convey is disposable. As soon as you get what I'm conveying, then you don't need to worry about the fact that I use this metaphor, namely convey. Stop being so chicken, you understand immediately that, or I understand immediately that you think I'm being too fearful. And the fact that you called me chicken is just a way of my realizing that you want to say that I'm being too fearful. But I'm not thinking, oh, chicken, huh, free range, organic, vegetarian feed. How old is that chicken? Egg laying? None of those things are relevant. So metaphors in everyday life, where we use them all the time, metaphors disappear at the moment of their use. The meaning comes across, and the vehicle that brought it to you doesn't matter anymore. In poetry, that doesn't happen. So here, you have something that's a metaphor for something else, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough, and it's not that you think, oh, okay, got it, now I understand the faces in the crowd, and you forget about the wet black bough, nor do you think, oh, got it, wet black bough, now I don't have to think about the metro anymore. They both subsist. So that is sort of going on at a major league level in Mont Blanc. So here he's thinking of the mind's relation to the world, and then the world intrudes. And then when you get something like the chainless winds still come and ever came to drink their odors and their mighty swinging to hear an old and solemn harmony, it's the winds come to hear the sound of the pines, but it's the winds that cause the pines to swing and therefore to make that sound. Still addressing the ravine of Arve, thine earthly rainbow stretched across the sweep of the ethereal waterfall. Again, just to notice this line by line, notice the contrast between earthly and ethereal. Thine earthly rainbow stretched across the sweep of the ethereal waterfall. It's really hard, because Shelley is so dense, to pay attention to Shelley word by word. But you should. Very few critics do, but you should. What's surprising about that pairing? Thine earthly rainbow stretched across the sweep of the ethereal waterfall. Yeah.
Oh, because like rainbow is really more ethereal.
Yeah. Than waterfall. Yeah, the waterfall, that's real. You don't have to be a poet to say, oh, look, a waterfall. You don't even have to be a poet to say, oh, look, a rainbow. But to think of a rainbow as ethereal, you probably do. But here we get this interesting reversal, which is thine earthly rainbows stretch across the sweep of the ethereal waterfall. Why does he do that in this philosophical poem? What two-line poem by Ezra Pound might you want to compare that to? Can I be clearer? What two-line poem by Ezra Pound that we've been talking about might you want to compare that to? Do you not remember the title? In a Station of the Metro? Maybe that two-line poem?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Why?
I think because like they use like apparition for the actual faces.
Yes. Nice.
Yeah.
So the faces are an apparition. And there's also this kind of reversal of what applies to what. So if the rainbows are earthly, that means they're a physical phenomenon. But at the same time as they become physical, they make the waterfall ethereal, as though not. It's again, it's almost as though there's a sort of switching of places in those metaphors. So the ethereal waterfall, whose veil robes some unsculptured image. So the waterfall veils something. It robes some unsculptured image. So there's an image behind the waterfall, but it's unsculptured. So what makes it an image? These are questions that you can have in the back of your mind. The idea would be that most images are sculptured, that the way he's using the word image is as a work of art. But here is an image that's unsculptured, veiled by the waterfall. The strange sleep which, when the voices of the desert fail, wraps all in its own deep eternity. So sometimes it's silent here, and then everything is wrapped in its own deep eternity. Again, notice the metaphors as you go through it. We're not going to go this slowly through the whole poem, obviously, but voices of the desert, that's a metaphor. It's a desert because it's a deserted place, not because it's got lots of sand and there's no water. Wraps all in its own deep eternity. Thy caverns echoing to the Arve's commotion. So the caverns of the ravine of Arve are echoing to the commotion of the Arve. A loud, lone sound no other sound contain. Thou art pervaded with that ceaseless motion. Thou art the path of that unresting sound. Dizzy ravine. So he's given now this 20-line description of the ravine of Arv. But all of this is because of a thus. Thus, thou ravine of Arv, you're just like what I described the mind as being as the universe of things flows through it. So now he says, so here it looks like, yeah, the world is really winning. Score several points for the world. So let's just do that again. World in stanza two. Mind in stanza two. We'll give 3 points to the world. How's that? The world looks like it's really winning. Dizzy ravine, and when I gaze on thee, I seem, as in a trance, sublime and strange, to muse on my own separate fantasy. My human mind, which passively now renders and receives fast influencings. So he gazes at the ravine, and what happens to it? What does he say it looks like to him? Yeah.
It looks different than what is really there. Like his own mind is making something more beautiful, more descriptive.
Yeah. And what he seems to be saying is, when I look at you, I see a picture of how my mind works. So suddenly he's turned the tables again. Dizzy ravine. And when I gaze on, and notice dizzy ravine, why is it called dizzy? Why would you call it a ravine dizzy? Is a ravine saying, oh, I don't know which way I'm going? So why would you call it dizzy?
I mean, it could be just he's been looking at the world for way too long.
Yeah, he's the one who's dizzy.
Yeah.
So it's like dizzying has come to be called dizzy. Have you seen examples of that in real life? Or something, I mean, I think dizzy is a word you might have seen used the way he's using it here. Like a dizzy height. Is that a phrase that makes sense to you? A dizzy height?
Yeah.
So notice that that is itself a strange kind of metaphor. Because the height isn't dizzy. It's that the height makes you dizzy. Just to look down from that height. Or even to look up at it and to think about it. But what you do is you project, and this is what this poem is about. You project what's in your own mind onto the height itself. It's not a metaphor where anyone's going to think, oh, a cool metaphor, you think that height is dizzy. But there is a sense that the projection, when you call something a dizzy height, is a little bit what you fear, that you're not simply within yourself, stable and not worried about falling. It's something is happening to your own sense of self, self-coincidence, to your own sense of being where you are. So the very fact that you would call the height dizzy is a kind of interesting way of describing the dizziness that you're feeling. It's almost a dizzy metaphor, which is interesting about it. So, dizzy ravine, and when I gaze on thee, I seem as in a trance, sublime and strange, to muse on my own separate fantasy, as though what I'm seeing is an image of my own mind, my human mind, which passively now renders and receives fast influencings. So I look at you, and it's as though my mind is passively rendering, that is, giving and receiving fast influencings from what I see around me, holding an unremitting interchange with the clear universe of things around. So what phrase have we seen before in that line? Yes, the universe of things. holding an unremitting interchange with the clear universe of things around. One legion of wild thoughts, whose wandering wings now float above thy darkness, and now rest where that is thy darkness, or thou art no unbidden guest. Or maybe it's where one legion is no unbidden guest. Where is all of this? In the still cave of the witch poesy, seeking among the shadows that pass by, ghosts of all things that are, some shade of thee, some phantom, some faint image, till the breast from which they fled recalls them, thou art there. So here, it's like he's looking at his own mind, and things are going back and forth between his mind and the world, rendering and receiving fast influencings, having this interchange with the clear universe of things around. And now, remember, this is still the question, mind or external world? World or poetry? He's saying, what if it's one legion of wild thoughts? The thoughts come from you, but the thoughts come from inside me as well. So there's a single legion of those wild thoughts, interchanging with the clear universe of things around. So there are thoughts that come from you that have interchanges with the universe, and thoughts that come from me that also have interchanges with the universe. And that legion, they're like birds whose wandering wings, one legion of wild thoughts, whose wandering wings, notice the metaphor there, now float above thy darkness, and now rest where that or thou art no unbidden guest in the still cave of the witch poesy. So where is, witch here means spirit. Where is the spirit of poetry? Outside or inside? Where is that cave? What's that cave a metaphor for?
The mind.
Yeah, it seems like it has to be the mind. So score one here for the mind, and we had another one for the mind where he says, I seem to muse in a trance sublime and strange on my own, my human mind. So the mind is trying to make a comeback. Looked for a while like the Ravine of Arv was pitching a no-hitter. See the metaphor there? But the mind seems to be making a comeback. And everything that passes by, seeking among the shadows that pass by, ghosts of all things that are, some shade of thee, some phantom, some faint image. So all things, the shadows that pass by, what are those? Again, yeah. Oh, it looked like you're using, okay. The metaphors here really do come fast and furious, and they flip really quickly. And one way to understand simply that, the shadows that pass by, that's a good metaphor for the world that we perceive. What is the world? Just shadows passing by. So if you say, I'm seeking among the shadows that pass by something permanent, everyone would know that what you meant was the world is just constantly disappointing me. It should be solid, it should be real things, but it's just all shadows. So seeking among the shadows that pass by would mean the external world is a shadow in which I try to find some shade of thee. And the question is, who's that thee? Maybe it means poetry itself. Maybe it means the source or the center of that darkness, but surrounded simply by shadows. And he's, but now he's looking some shade of, let's call it, poetry itself. Some phantom, some faint image of poetry itself. So he's trying to find that in the world. So the world is just phantoms and faint images. And that's what he's looking for. Till the breast from which they fled, that is the legion of wild thoughts, recalls them. Thou art there. Is that thou the same as the thee two lines earlier? Again, just think of the dynamism of this poem, which is what he's trying to say is, mountain, you're just shadows that pass by. But then suddenly he looks at the mountain and says, whoops, I wanted to think of all the, this as shadows, but thou art there. There you are. The breast from which they fled recalls them. Could be his own mind. But he says, as soon as I look out on the mountains and try to think that I'm like you, I only see shadows and shades. But you, mountain, are there. There's nothing I can do about it. So it looks like the mountain has won game two of this five-game match of these playoffs. Okay, stanza three. A little more philosophy. Some say that gleams of a remoter world visit the soul in sleep, that death is slumber, and that its shapes the busy thoughts outnumber of those who wake and live. So, what do some people think? When you're asleep, what do you see?
Dreams.
Dreams, and those dreams come from?
Your mind.
Okay, good. They come from your mind. So now we're going to say, mind, score one for the mind, at least for what some say. A remoter world?
Okay, is that about the mind, or is it like saying that's something separate?
Okay, so it's what it's ultimately about is an idea in Plato, who Shelley loved. And the idea is this world is illusion, and where our souls really belong is to this other remote world where we are part of that remote world, not perceivers of it, but complete livers within it. So it's not that there's the mind perceiving something outside of itself. That's only in this lower world. In this higher world, says Plato, and Shelley is attracted to this idea, in this higher world, we belong equally. We too are ideal minds. So we are surrounded by ideals, but we are also ideals. We are surrounded by forms, but we're also forms. So one philosophical view, the sum here is Platonists or a Platonic theory of dreaming, is the reason we dream is we are remembering or being revisited by something which transcends this world. So he doesn't quite want, he also wants this just to be when you dream, you know, it could be science fiction dreaming. It could be this world is the simulation, but when we go to sleep, have any of you seen Severance? So it could be a little bit like Severance. You should all watch Severance. It's totally great. Did you like it?
It was so phenomenal. I wasn't, like, after the first episode, I thought it was not, but it's really amazing.
It is really amazing. There's a season two coming.
Yeah.
One of the great things about Severance is every time you have an idea or a question, it's like, wait a second, but they deal with it immediately. It's like they do it in the next episode, just the thing you started worrying about. So yeah, so Severance isn't quite about a simulation, but it comes out of that background, you know, going back to the Matrix, or even further to Neuromancer, William Gibson's great novel Neuromancer. So it could all be a simulation, and it may be that when you're asleep, you are actually transporting into a perception of the truer world, the remoter world. So some say that gleams of a remoter world visit the soul in sleep. If that's true, then maybe death is only slumber, which is to say that you go to this remoter world when you die, that death is slumber, and that its shapes, the busy thoughts, outnumber of those who wake and live. So, great moment in Antony and Cleopatra, where Cleopatra, after Antony dies, says to someone who is trying to get her to surrender, but who also has, admires her, she says, "I dreamt there was an emperor, Antony. Oh, such another sleep that I might have, but such another dream." And then she describes Antony, and talks about his extraordinary, transcendent qualities. And then she says to this guy, "Think you there could be but such a man as this I dreamt of?" And the guy responds to her, "Gentle madam, no. The dream you just described couldn't be in the real world." And she says, "You're wrong." She says, "Thou liest up to the hearing of the gods," she says. And then she goes on, "Nature wants stuff to vie strange forms with fancy." That is, you can always imagine more than nature can give you. Nature wants stuff to vie strange forms with fancy. But to imagine an Antony where nature's peace against fancy, condemning shadows quite. And what she's saying there is no person could have imagined Antony. He was so amazing that no human mind could imagine him. Only nature could have created him. He has to be real because he was unimaginably great. You couldn't imagine someone as great as Antony was. So if you can't imagine it, but there was someone like that, he had to be real. A really interesting argument. Anyone know the so-called ontological proof for the existence of God? So you should know this. It's a very simple proof given by St. Anselm in 1,000 years ago. And he basically says, let's define God. God is perfect in every way. God is he than whom nothing greater can be thought. That is Anselm's definition. If God's not perfect, he's not God. So by definition, God is perfect. So let me ask you, he says, although not in those words, he says, let me ask you, which is better, something that exists or something that doesn't exist? He says, it's obvious that if it doesn't exist, it's like of no value. Which would you prefer, an imaginary coin or a real coin? An imaginary credit card or a real credit card? An imaginary $100 bill or a real $100 bill? So reality is always superior to what isn't real. So if God is the greatest thing, the most perfect thing, the thing then which nothing greater can be thought in every aspect, so big you can't get over him, so low you can't get under him, so wide you can't get around him, to use an old preacherly description. He's the biggest, he's the best, he's the kindest, he's the justest, he's the most merciful, and so on. He's perfect. Any aspect, anything you can think about, God has that thing in perfection. All powerful, all-knowing, omnipresent. By definition, that's what God is, says Anselm. And then he says, but anything that exists is greater than something that doesn't exist. God, if he is the greatest in all things, has to have the greatest existence of all things. So by definition, he exists. As soon as you think God, and as soon as you understand the definition, you understand that he has to exist. So that's the world utterly, overwhelmingly defeating the mind for Anselm. If you can imagine God, you are imagining a being who necessarily exists. Because if you imagine he doesn't exist, you're not imagining God. How could you be? If you're imagining you're imagining a phantom, not God. So that is the proof that he offers for the existence of God, which people hasn't really convinced very many people. But it's philosophically interesting what you have to do to show that it's wrong as a proof. And it's kind of what Cleopatra is saying, which is you can't imagine an Antony. Someone like him is unimaginably great. Therefore, he has to exist. So something like that is happening here, too. Shelley loved Antony and Cleopatra. He knew Anselm's proof, but he loved Antony and Cleopatra. So, do I lie and dream? Has some unknown omnipotence unfurled the veil of life and death? Or do I lie and dream, and does the mightier world of sleep spread far around and inaccessibly its circles? So is this all coming out of the mind? Does the mightier world of sleep spread far around and inaccessibly its circles? For the very spirit fails, driven like a homeless cloud from steep to steep that vanishes among the viewless gales. So first he thinks he might be asleep, and then he says, this thing is so tremendous that my spirit is completely overawed by it. Driven like a homeless cloud from steep to steep that vanishes among the viewless gales. So who's winning there? The world. Yeah, the spirit is a homeless cloud, driven around, far, far above, piercing the infinite sky, Mont Blanc appears. So again, it's like the infinite sky is this idea we have. And then there's the mountain, and it just pierces right through it. It's like it overwhelms this image, this fantasy, this dream of infinity. Piercing the infinite sky, Mont Blanc appears, still snowy and serene. So the world is really winning here. Its subject mountains, their unearthly forms pile around it, ice and rock, broad veils between a frozen floods, unfathomable deeps, blue as the overhanging heaven that spread and wind among the accumulated steeps, a desert peopled by the storms alone, save when the eagle brings some hunter's bone and the wolf tracks her there. How hideously its shapes are heaped around, rude, bare, and high, ghastly, and scarred, and riven. Is this the scene where the old earthquake demon taught her young ruin? So, all inhuman. Is this where earthquakes learn to be earthquakes? Were these their toys? Or did a sea of fire envelop once this silent snow? So he's completely overwhelmed by the world here. Let me just ask you, what form is this poem in? The lines are written in, some say that gleams of a remoter world. Iambic pentameter, yep. Visit the soul in sleep, that death is slumber. Okay, so is it blank verse? No. Why not?
I think it rhymes with that number.
Yeah, the whole poem rhymes. You may not have noticed this, but it's a rhyming poem. And one of the amazing things about it is how the power of the images and the compelling power of the lines make the rhyme take a back seat. But yeah, world rhymes with, just look at the beginning of stanza three, world rhymes with unfurled, slumber without number, that's easy, high with, okay, sleep with, inaccessibly is rhyming with lie and high, just to tell you it's one of those Lee rhymes that rhyme with I rhymes. Fails and sky, back to lie and high and inaccessibly. So one thing about this poem is that it rhymes, but most people, the first time they read it, don't notice that it rhymes. Did everyone notice? How many people noticed it right away, that it rhymes? How many people are only realizing that right now? Yeah, that's pretty cool, that if a poem rhymes and you don't notice it rhymes, then one thing that often happens with rhyme poetry is, that word is there for the rhyme. That's why violets are blue. It's not happening here. That somehow it's all falling into place. Do you think that fact, that it rhymes without calling attention to itself, unlike, say, Pope, remember, where'er you hear the cooling western breeze and the next line it whispers through the
breeze.
Yes. If drowsy streams with pleasing murmurs creep, the readers threaten not in vain with
sleep.
Yeah. Remember, Pope calls those sure returns of still expected rhymes. In Shelley, the rhymes are there. Shelley is one of the, he doesn't only write rhyming poetry, but he's one of the great rhymers in the history of English poetry. The rhymes are there, but you may not notice them. If you're taking form as metaphorical, remember we talked about how James Merrill uses, when he writes about his father, what rhyme scheme does he use? Do you remember? ABBA. Which means father in Hebrew, and it's a New Testament word. St. Paul uses it to say that we will call Abba father. It's not the terrible rock band, but it means father. So their form, ABBA, is itself being used as a kind of metaphor for the thing it's designating. Do you think something like that is happening here? I don't mean by way of rhyme scheme. The rhyme scheme is irregular. It's just the case that every line rhymes. But do you think something like that might be happening here in this competition between world and poem? How would the fact that it rhymes contribute to the competition?
Wings.
Why?
Because it rhymes.
Okay, so
it's like altered reality.
It's altered reality, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, he's using the words like about the world to make the poem rhyme, which means the world's kind of just like complementing the poem. Like they're like the mechanics of it, like it's being used to create a bigger like image of the poem, which is like through the line. But
so it's like the world is doing the rhyming. All right.
It's like little pawns, like the words which are describing the world.
Okay. So the world is presenting itself to him as something that if he just describes it, it's going to rhyme. So the world would be in control of the rhyme.
No, the world's like the words are the world, right? Like it's the metaphor that's the rhyme. And the fact that
manipulate
these little, like the world words and these little things to make the bigger image of the rhyme of the poem is like, I don't know, kind of minuscule, like they're more trivial to him. Like he can use those.
Okay, wait, so who wins then?
The mind.
The mind. Okay, so you're agreeing.
I'm agreeing.
Yeah. The fact that this is all rhyming is a way that the world is being subordinated or fit into what the mind is doing. Okay, so it's not just, here's this stuff in the world and all I'm going to do is say what I see. It's my saying it arranges it in a certain way, and I'm the one doing the arranging, not the world. Okay, neat. Okay, so there's the mountain. There is the place where the earthquake demon might have taught her young ruin. Were these their toys? Did it see a fire envelop once the silent snow? Was it once a volcano, is what he's asking. None can reply. All seems eternal now. The wilderness has a mysterious tongue, which teaches awful doubt, or faith so mild, so solemn, so serene that man may be, but for such faith, with nature reconciled. So all you might need is that faith that nature would teach you. Then you could be reconciled with nature. So maybe I'm learning something. That's really good. Maybe nature cares about us. Thou hast a voice, great mountain, to repeal large codes of fraud and woe, not understood by all, but which the wise and great and good interpret or make felt or deeply feel. So looks like we got to a happy ending there. That is, that if you were to look at nature and understand it and understand that nature cares for us, then we could feel that you would teach us to be better people. Shelley was a radical leftist, and he actually got expelled from college because of some of the pamphleteering he did when he was a student. But he's basically saying, look at this mountain. Look at how tremendous it is. Look how it is saying that ruin and so on, not such good things. You could repeal everything bad done by those in power because you're more powerful. So that's what he's hoping. And now he starts listing the fields, the lakes, the forests, and the streams, ocean, and all the living things that dwell within the daedal earth. Anyone want to guess what daedal means? It's a word Shelley likes. It's not his own word, but it's a word he uses several times in his poetry. Does it look like a proper name that you know? From Greek mythology? Mm-hmm. What are you thinking?
Daedalus.
Yeah. So the daedal earth is an earth like the labyrinth. It means complex and intricate, like the labyrinth that Daedalus built for the Minotaur. People know that story? Anyone not? So a queen in ancient Greece has sex with a bull and gives birth to a half man, half bull who is very violent and demands the sacrifice of young women to eat every year. And in order to give him a place to live, the great inventor Daedalus, who invented lots of things, you probably know the story of Daedalus and his son Icarus and how he made wings for them, built a labyrinth in which the Minotaur lives and can't find his way out of. And the young women are sent into the labyrinth every year, and when the Minotaur finds them, he kills them. And eventually Theseus comes and defeats the Minotaur and finds his way out of the labyrinth because the woman that he's seeing at the time, whom he then treats badly, of course, gives him a ball of thread. And so he just leaves. He's sort of like, this is where Hansel and Gretel comes from. The same way that Hansel is dropping stones as he leaves the house, Theseus is unwinding this thread. So after he's killed the Minotaur, because he's a great Greek hero, he can find his way back by just retracing his steps following the thread. But the word daedal means very, very intricate, like the labyrinth. So the fields, you should use it in a paper for someone. Probably has to be an English professor, but you know, maybe some other professor, they'll look it up and then they'll find that cool. So, the fields, the lakes, the forests, and the streams, ocean, and all the living things that dwell within the daedal earth, lightning and rain, earthquake and fiery flood and hurricane, the torpor of the year when feeble dreams visit the hidden buds, or dreamless sleep holds every future leaf and flower, the bound with which from that detested trance they leap, that is, from the trance of the dreamless sleep in the winter. But then spring comes, the bound with which from that detested trance they leap, the works and ways of man, their death and birth, and that of him and all that his may be, all things that move and breathe with toil and sound are born and die, revolve, subside, and swell. So you get a description of the natural world. It sounds like it's going to be a happy one. Fields and lakes and forests and streams and ocean and all these wonderful things. But it turns out that everything is born and then dies. Whereas power dwells apart in its tranquility, remote, serene, and inaccessible. And this, the naked countenance of earth on which I gaze, even these primeval mountains teach the adverting mind, that is the mind that's paying attention, that power doesn't care about us. So who's winning now? Power, the mountain. We just live and die. It dwells apart in its tranquility. The glaciers creep like snakes that watch their prey from their far fountains. Slow, fountains there mean sources, the sources of the glaciers. Slow rolling on. There, many a precipice, frost and the sun and scorn of mortal power have piled. Dome, pyramid, and pinnacle, a city of death, distinct with many a tower and wall impregnable of beaming ice. So, nope, guess who's winning? The city of death, scorn of mortal power. Guess who's winning?
Hello?
Yeah, the mountain does not care about us. So what's happening, we'll finish this. We actually will finish it on Tuesday, which is pretty impressive to do it in 3 days. I know we've been rushing through it. But what keeps happening is he keeps trying to imagine the mountain as something that the mind can come up to and with. And every time he does that, he makes a mistake of looking at it again, and he says, nope, I was wrong. Human life, nothing. All life, nothing. There is power dwelling apart in its tranquility. Tranquility there means it couldn't care less about us. Remote, serene, and inaccessible. So as we get to the bottom of the fourth, how's that? It looks like the world is winning by a lot. Not that the world cares that it's winning. That's one of the reasons it's winning. Is it has no interest whatever in whether it's winning or not. Okay, have a good weekend. Remember the quiz. And see you Tuesday. And remember that if you need an extension, send me an iambic pentameter sentence asking for one. Okay, bye everybody.
If we still have like questions about